Good morning, welcome. Today is Tuesday, 2nd of September, La Rentrée, and we are here to talk about many topics today, but let's start with this devastating earthquake that took place on Sunday in Afghanistan. We have the pleasure to have with us Indrika Ratwater, who's the humanitarian coordinator in Afghanistan, who's connecting from Kabul. We will hear from him, and as his time is really limited, we will ask questions. I will open the floor to questions to Indrika after the introductory remarks, and then we will also speak with other agencies on the situation in Afghanistan, in particular with Joy Singhal, who is the IFRC acting head of delegation for Afghanistan, also connecting from Kabul, and our own Babar, who is also going to tell us about Afghanistan. That's the first part of the briefing, then we will go to the other matters. But before giving the floor to Indrika Ratwater, I would like to read to you the statement attributable to the spokesperson of the Secretary General on Afghanistan, where he says that the Secretary General is deeply saddened by the devastating loss of life caused by Sunday's earthquake in Afghanistan's eastern Nangarhar province. Initial reports indicate that more than 800 people have been killed and many more injured. Casualty figures are expected to rise as search and rescue teams reach affected communities located in remote and mountainous locations. The Secretary General expresses his solidarity with the people of Afghanistan, extends sincere condolences to the families of the victims, and wishes a speedy recovery to those injured. The United Nations and our partners in Afghanistan are coordinating with the de facto authorities to swiftly assess needs, provide emergency assistance, and stand ready to mobilize additional support. An emergency appeal is being developed by the United Nations and our partners, and an initial $5 million from the UN Emergency Fund, SURF, has been released. The United Nations in Afghanistan will spare no efforts to assist people, but current humanitarian funding is insufficient to address the needs. The Secretary General calls for additional humanitarian resources to urgently respond to the tragedy and crisis at hand. And I'm sure that Indrika will have much more on that. So I give the floor to Ocha. Jens, we go directly to Kabul. Okay, go ahead, please.
Am I on? Sorry, yes. Can you hear me okay?
We can. Please okay. Go ahead.
Thank you very much for giving me this opportunity to brief you. As you all know, 24 hours almost plus ago, 6+ magnitude earthquake hit. Mostly the epicenter was in Nangarhar province, but impacting four other provinces, Kunar, Lagman, and Nuristan. And as we hear from the assessments, it's mostly impacted Kunar of these provinces, as in terms of the highest devastation. 800+ individuals have sadly perished, and we are looking at over 2,000 injured, and the numbers are definitely going to increase as far as we can see. Also, remembering that in 22 and in 23, we had devastating earthquakes in Afghanistan. So looking at the stats, looking at the remoteness and the topography, which is extremely challenging and remote, we think potentially the impacted individuals could go up to almost into the hundreds of thousands. So far, we know around 12,000 individuals have been directly impacted in these provinces. And if you look at these provinces as a whole, around 3 million people inhabit these provinces. So the density, while remote, is also quite high potential impacts for the population. One thing really important to remember in this earthquake, as opposed to what happened in Herat in the west, is this is extremely mountainous. And due to the earthquake, there's been lots of landslides, rockfalls, et cetera, and access has been very limited to everybody in the first 24 hours. This has posed a huge challenge to us as we deploy. Right now, as we speak, 20 of our emergency assessment teams have been deployed. to do assessments, which is critical in these areas. 15 mobile teams have been put out there, and UNHANS, the humanitarian flights from Kabul to Jalalabad, which is the capital of Nangarhar province, closest air logistics, is being mobilizing more flights. However, the biggest challenge is to reach these remote areas with the road access extremely damaged. We need helicopters and because fixed-wing aircraft cannot do the job. And the government has responded by deploying three helicopters constantly to evacuate individuals who are injured, deploy search and rescue teams and medical teams. And we are in close coordination with the Afghan National Disaster Management Entity, ANDMA, and relevant ministries to coordinate the response and have a joined up approach to this emergency. I think it's important to see that in cases like this and from experience from before, the immediate needs are emergency shelter, non-food items, food assistance for the populations affected, and very important medical assistance coming from IV fluids, saline, bandages, and to deal with the injured, but also to those who have more sustained more serious injuries. And it is traumatic for the communities. So protection interventions, including psychosocial support for individuals who've lost family and loved ones, remains very important. At the same time, the disposal of bodies and the removal of livestock carcasses is extremely important to avoid waterborne diseases, which can happen very, very fast. Altitude is high in these areas, in the more mountainous villages, and evening temperatures are quite significantly lower. So this is also something which we had to take into account while accessing these areas. I think what is important to remember is the context of Afghanistan, and this is a crisis within a crisis. If you look at the multiple shocks that Afghanistan has absorbed just this year, we've had over 1.7 million Afghans returning from Iran and Pakistan this year. We've had a drought with very, very low rainfall impacting 70% of the population, which is agrarian and relies on agriculture. And on top of that, devastating funding cuts for the humanitarian and basic assistance programs in this country. We have had to close hundreds of facilities given these the funding cuts. So the earthquake comes at a time where vulnerable communities are going to be super exposed to additional stresses, shocks, and vulnerabilities, where humanitarian staff are working around the clock to reach these people impacted. And on the other side, of course, we do have returns coming in exponential numbers still into the country and dealing with the drought. So I think really to appeal here very strongly to international support and solidarity to assist the Afghan populations affected here at this very, very dire time. And winter is around the corner, as we know. By way of the overall resource picture, the Afghanistan Humanitarian Response Plan, the HNRP, in September remains funded only at 28%. This is rather dire, to say the least. And here we have an emergency on top of the crisis situation. Lastly, also to reiterate that our response, again, will include key staff in terms of technical capacity, medical, water sanitation, et cetera, and health, but importantly also female colleagues who have to be a critical part of the response, reaching vulnerable households, female heads of households, and providing critical psychosocial support and protection interventions for the affected populations. While the de facto authorities are trying their best to step up, I think this is a moment that the international community has to show solidarity with the people of Afghanistan at a time where multiple crises, rightly so, is taking attention and resources. We cannot afford to forget the people of Afghanistan who, as I've said before, are facing multiple crises, multiple shocks, and resilience of the communities has been saturated. And these are life and death decisions while we race against time to reach the people.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ratwata. And as I said, I know your time is a little bit counted, especially at this moment. So we will open the floor to questions to you. But as I said, afterwards, we will also hear from IFRC and from UNHCR on Afghanistan, the situation in Afghanistan too. So are there questions to Mr. Ratwata? I see Jamie Keaton is our correspondent of Associated Press.
Thank you, Mr. Ratwata, for coming to see us. Compared to the Herat earthquake of 2023, how is this latest disaster different in terms of the scale of humanitarian needs, response capacity, international engagement, and as well as the topographical factors? And what must the de facto authorities do to prepare themselves and the population to face this kind of challenge in the future? So how much resilience is really there in Afghanistan to deal with this situation?
Mr. Ratwata?
Thank you very much, Jamie. I think let me start with your first point about the resilience. I think the resilience of all concerned in the response, including the United Nations and our national partners and international partners who are on the ground, has been stretched precisely for the reasons I was mentioning before. The huge funding cuts, the refugee returnee response, and the drought. So we are at breaking point in terms of response overall to the multiple humanitarian shocks in the country. The authorities also have been trying to, in their own way, make that lift in response to these areas. If you look at the Afghan National Disaster Response Authority, their capacity is limited. They have deployed everything they have. And from a lessons learned perspective from Herat, I think there are three key points which challenge us in this particular context. If you take the Kunar province, which has been impacted the most, this is extremely mountainous. The altitude is high. The road access from key points like Jalalabad, which is the main airport, for example, for airlifting assets to bringing in humanitarian assistance and staff, it's extremely remote. Whereas in Herat, it is a big hub, much better connectivity to the affected areas. So the, just in terms of connectivity, serious challenges. Secondly, we have to still get high resolution satellite imagery to confirm this. But our assessment is that the impacted areas are valleys in the mountains, which are very spread out. And they are not concentrated like in the Herat area, where, in relatively speaking, where you could reach these areas easily. And the fact that landslides, given the mountainous areas and the rockfalls, have impeded access was not a challenge we had in Herat, because that is flat topography. So really, topographical, geographical challenges are compounding our access. And as we speak right now, the UN and others are trying to set up or repair damaged mobile connectivity, because there's zero connectivity with some of these communities. And even to bring in helicopters and land, where I see the de facto authorities are having problems as well, it's not easy to get to these areas and keep shuttling injured individuals to the main hospital. So these are some of the differences between Herat response in terms of connectivity, topography, and access. Lastly, I think in terms of the de facto authorities and their capacity, because of the de facto authorities not being recognized, as we know, what one would do normally with a recognized government is to build capacity of national institutions like the National Disaster Response Authority. There are serious limitations to that. And I think the constraints on the United Nations and others to try to meaningfully capacitate and provide technical assistance to authorities like ANDMA, which is the authority responsible for coordinating a national response, is a big hindrance. So yes, Their resilience also to that extent has been impeded by the inability for us to provide that capacity support to them. But in moments like this, we are working in a coordinated manner to maximize our efficiencies on the ground and save lives, because time is of a sense, as you know, in these disasters. The first 24 to 72 hours is where the life and death issues matter, particularly search and rescue and medical services to those seriously injured at stake.
Thank you very much. I think you have a follow-up, Jamie.
Yes, thank you so much for that answer. If I could also just follow up, I was going back over what you said in your opening remarks, that you mentioned that as many as that we could, the impacted individuals could go up almost into the hundreds of thousands. Could you try to give us a little bit more detail on that? Impacted, it can be a very widely interpreted term. So how many people are you talking about that actually, what is your estimate that the total casualty count in particular will ultimately be?
I think that, Jamie, it's too early at this point of time to provide that, because first of all, as I said, we deployed teams yesterday, 20 teams, the government has deployed teams, and because of access challenge, it would be premature to speculate. But if you were to model it based on what's happened before, clearly, there's no question that the casualty rate is going to be rather exponential. Also, in these areas, unlike in peri-urban areas where you have concrete structures, these are mud and wooden roof structures. So when the walls collapse, the roof is what basically falls on individuals, kills them or suffocates them. So it's low density, but since this happened in the night, everybody was sleeping. So I think it's going to be much higher. And when we said hundreds of thousands impacted, as in houses destroyed, injured, casualties, livestock lost, and any livelihood systems that they had, as sparse as it is in these areas, destroyed. If you model it on numbers from the previous earthquakes here in this area of 22 and 23, it could potentially go into the 100,000. But again, we don't want to speculate until we have a bit more granular data, which we'll be getting collectively within the next 48 to 72 hours.
Thank you very much. Robin is our correspondent of AFP. Robin.
Thank you. All those items that you mentioned that need to get there quickly, emergency shelter, non-food items, IV fluids, etc. What's the picture that you're looking at? Do you have those items? Do you have them in sufficient numbers? And secondly, can you get them there in time? As you mentioned, it's a race against time, but I mean, do you think that this is a race against time that you're not going to win because of the topography?
I think two points, Robin. One is that usually in a situation like Afghanistan, where we have, just by our normal assessments, where half the population right now, 22.5 million people are in need in this country, half the population, anyway, from one form or the other of humanitarian assistance, where food security is a challenge, where infant and maternal mortality is high. We have systemic humanitarian challenges that need to be met. And as I said, we are 28% funded in September. On top of that have been the critical funding cuts. And in a normal situation like last year, the warehouses of partners and agencies, funds and programs would have been adequately stocked with emergency response materials. But after last year's massive floods, those were emptied. And when I was talking with the teams today and discussing, they didn't have the resources to replenish these stocks. So the in-country stocks are next to nothing. We are scrambling, pulling whatever is available in the region, number one, and deploying it as we speak. We have reached out to the neighboring countries and others further afield. And I'm happy to see that there's already a response being mounted, in-country procurement and delivery of goods. But also some airlifts are being seen. I think quite a few governments have responded. And this morning, I was also told that the EU and others are also trying to support through airbridge flights into Jalalabad. And I see the Indian government also is bringing in stuff. and the Qataris and others. So we have been really reaching out to the international community to step it up. But it is a race against time. We don't have enough of the essential items on the ground for sure. And that's because, as I said, the resources have not been there. And we've been dealing with multiple crises. We had 1.7 plus million refugees and returnees come back to this country just this year. I'm not counting last year, where another almost 800,000 individuals came into this country. So these people go back to the existing communities, and they are extremely saturated. So to summarize, I think we need a major, urgent step up by the international community to respond to this crisis.
Indeed, and we will hear more from UNHCR on the issue of refugees. One more question from Jeremy Lange, Radio France Internationale.
Thank you, Alessandra. I understand that you don't want to speculate on the death toll, but is it safe to say that already we can expect that it will exceed the death toll in Herat in 2023? And the second question will be on the de facto authorities. Have they sought for international assistance already? You mentioned the need for helicopters. Do we know if Pakistan, for instance, is willing to send helicopters to Afghanistan?
Okay.
Yeah, now we can hear you. Go ahead, Mr. Ratwat.
Okay. Two things. We, as I said, are coordinating very closely with the authorities to do three things. One is really to try to come together as fast as possible on the needs, based on the needs assessment that has been done on the ground, that we can really summarize the top line items, which I've already mentioned here. And then secondly, to see what's already being committed by generous member states and others and the private sector as well, that we are prioritizing, that if we are getting enough emergency shelter and tents and not enough medicine, then that's the calibration we need to do ASAP. And thirdly, I think trying to do a quick assessment based on that of the resources needed, because one part is the emergency response, which is critical in the first 72 hours, and then going into the I would say the first month. And after that, you got to also look at what we call supporting the recovery phase as well, because winter is coming and winterized tents or trying to have some indigenous shelters which are quickly set up to weather a very, very cold winter is needed. So the authorities have been told, let's try to be coordinated in this, present the needs, and obviously make an ask for international support, which I believe they are in the process of doing. And I think very soon you may be hearing some official statements from them requesting international support for this. But from the side of the United Nations, obviously, in such emergencies, with the Coordination Office of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, and together with me and the team on the ground, we'll be also looking at what we call a flash appeal of the critical needs that are needed out fast. But that also really depends on quick assessments on the ground, and we'll see what our teams come back in the next 48 to 72 hours, and to collate that with the caveat that as we reach more and more areas, those needs will change, but we want to get something out as soon as possible to the international community also in terms of what is needed and what are the resources that can be put on the ground in addition to the in-kind support that's coming right now.
Mr. Ratwat, thank you so much for being with us this morning. Really thank you very much and invite you to continue updating our journalists here, especially when you will have the more precise assessment. I know you don't have much time, so thank you very much for being here, but we will continue speaking about Afghanistan now with the other two invitees. Jens stays with me for OCHA on the podium, and we are now going to listen from IFRC The acting head of delegation for Afghanistan, Mr. Joy Singhal, is with us, also from Kabul. And Babar will tell us more about the situation of the refugees that, as Mr. Rawat said, it's an extremely important part of this crisis. So I give the floor now to Mr. Singhal and then to Babar, and we will reopen the floor to questions afterwards. Mr. Singhal, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much. Can you confirm you can hear me well?
Very well, thank you.
Excellent, thank you. So, I mean, I'll actually start by saying that Indrika has covered the situation analysis and the needs of the ground extremely well. So I'll try to not repeat, but at the same time, try to reinforce some of the messages that he has mentioned. So first of all, to say that Afghanistan is a country in crisis for the past several years. I mean, this is a country that has faced earthquakes, not just in 2023, but also in 2024. And we have responded to both of those earthquakes from the Afghanistan Red Crescent and the IFRC Red Cross Network. This particular earthquake has happened in an extremely difficult terrain. I mean, it's all mountainous. The rains have affected the roads already before the earthquake happened. But the unique thing about the Afghanistan Red Crescent is that they were already on the ground before the earthquake happened. They are from those communities. So within an hour of the earthquake happening, those communities who were themselves affected were trying to be engaged into search and rescue operations of the communities which are affected, friends and families and the neighbors. And early in the morning of the next day, of Monday morning, I mean, we started to receive live information from our staff and volunteers on the ground from Afghan Red Crescent in terms of the damage that they are seeing. And that is quite significant and massive. If we want to make a comparison with 2023 earthquake that happened in some similar locations, or to the Herat earthquake, it's going to be significantly different in terms of the casualties and in terms of our inability to reach those people in time because of the difficult terrain. So we just need to be mindful of that fact that we are not able to reach several people who would need our assistance and who could have been saved if the road transport or the networks were easy for us to be able to support those communities. Now, what we are also seeing that our staff and volunteers sometimes have to be walking for about 4 to 5 hours to reach some of those remote villages. And once they reach there, they have to walk back and bring those affected and wounded people into the city center. And the two hospitals there are overrun with capacity. So humanitarian needs are very high from a emergency health perspective. And hospitals are, as I was saying, are really overwhelmed, and thousands of families are without shelter. Psychosocial support is also particularly required for children. We did have prepositioned supplies in Kabul and also in those areas, Jalalabad, for example, which we can dispatch very, very quickly. However, the challenge for us would be we would not be able to reach the most remote mountainous areas to support those people. So it would be, in a way, a race against time, but a very patient response. And it could actually become a protracted crisis for the next few months as to how do we support those communities once they are able to reach in some safer locations. I finally want to stress one thing, that Afghanistan, as I was saying earlier, has been grappling with severe crisis over the past few years. The social security services or basic need services for the communities in Afghanistan have already been overwhelmed. The government do not have enough resources to provide for humanitarian assistance and basic needs for all of its population. It has seen recently a large influx of people coming into Afghanistan from the neighboring countries, and that has compounded the humanitarian needs for even the people who are not affected by an earthquake or by other crises. So, and this particular earthquake is going to take resources away from other responses that we are working on. And that resource movement is also then going to affect other locations where we are working. So essentially, we would need additional resources to support this crisis right here, right now, almost immediately. And yes, completely acknowledge that there are several other crises happening across the world right now, but I think Afghanistan should not be forgotten. And this is an earthquake which is in the news right now, but we again just need to be mindful that we continue to keep these communities in our mind in the next months and not just right now. There was a question asked in terms of preparedness for similar crises in the future. I mean, we can preposition supplies. But still, I mean, what is required is really sustained investment into the services of the government, of peoples, for them to be resilient over a longer duration of time. This would require sustained support from humanitarians and development actors to Afghanistan people for a long duration. Again, from an IFRC, International Federation of the Red Cross, and Afghanistan Red Crescent perspective, because the Afghanistan Red Crescent is a local actor, they were the first responders on the ground. They have been able to get on to even the government air flights to be able to do search and rescue and aerial assessments. And ultimately, they are still being guided by independent, impartial, and neutral humanitarian action. Finally, before I conclude my message, I just wanted to share a story about a boy who is the sole survivor of the recent earthquake. And as he recounted by one of my colleagues on the ground, he was crying in pain when he was rescued, but still he was not fully aware of what it meant to lose his entire family in this disaster. I think we just need to be aware of several of these families right now who would be affected by this disaster, and they would have to live this throughout their life. And because Afghanistan is in such a chronic crisis, if we are not able to support these people, I think we have seen a peaceful Afghanistan as compared to the past few years. And I think we as an international community have a responsibility to help Afghanistan maintain that level of peacefulness that this country has seen in several decades. Otherwise, we would not just fail the people of earthquake, but we would be failing the people of Afghanistan in general. Thank you very much. I hand it over back to you.
Thank you very much. Thanks very much for this information and call. I'll give the floor to Babar for UNHCR for the situation of refugees.
Thank you, dears, and huge thanks to our colleagues in Kabul. Just to add to the efforts that are ongoing on our behalf as UNHCR, following Sunday's devastating earthquake in Afghanistan, UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, has joined the response to help affected communities. From the early hours of yesterday, UNHCR, with our other humanitarian partners, have rushed to the worst hit areas to help and provide support. As with the interagency rapid needs assessment ongoing, we are also part of the humanitarian efforts which is happening on the ground. Essential relief items have been pre-positioned from UNHCR's Kabul stockpiles, and these include tents, blankets, and solar lamps. We are also exploring the option of bringing more relief from other places in the region and our global stockpiles. In the region, just across the border in Termez in Uzbekistan, UNHCR has a regional stockpile of humanitarian relief that we can quickly mobilize. As people mourn their loved ones, health services are overwhelmed, and rescue operations are hindered by the lack of basic infrastructure in many of the affected areas. UNHCR tents and other relief items will be a lifesaver. We are particularly concerned for women and children affected by the earthquake, who will again be among the worst hit and most at risk. Support to women and girls may be complicated further by a shortage of female humanitarian staff to respond to their specific needs. We are working with the national and international partners to ensure people with special needs are identified and receive the required support, including with those with disabilities and older people, child and female headed household. As the return of Afghans and refugees was being mentioned from the neighboring countries, I want to update on that. Communities in Afghanistan have already been struggling to integrate 2.4 million Afghans who have returned or been forced to return from Pakistan and Iran this year. This is the most updated figure that we at UNHCR have. As you mentioned, other numbers, but our latest numbers that have been updated now now show that 2.4 million Afghans have returned or been forced to return from the neighboring Iran and Pakistan. Since April, over 3,095 Afghans have returned from Pakistan to Afghanistan, and a majority of these people, some 318,000 of them, have passed through the Thorham border crossing, which is from Pakistan into Afghanistan, and this is very close to the epicenter. And our data also shows that the majority of returnees are going to these regions that have been affected by the earthquake. With the third, and also moving on to another worrying development, with the 31st of August marking the end of grace period for registered Afghan refugees in Pakistan, we at UNHCR are also preparing for significantly more returns in the coming days. These people, already with very little resources, are now returning to a disaster zone. Humanitarian assistance is needed to help them and avoid further tragedies. As mentioned, our stocks and capacity to respond in these emergencies are already stretched thin. More support is needed and fast. We appeal, we join the appeals to the donor community globally to urgently support with the required relief effort. Thank you.
Absolutely. Let me open the floor to more questions, if any, in the room. Let me see if there is any hand up. Robin Millard. Robin, as I said before, Joy is our correspondent of AFP.
Papa, what could be the impact of the numbers that you're talking about returning from Afghanistan into this devastated zone? And have you reached out to the Pakistani authorities to see if there could potentially be any possible leeway on this issue?
I mean, even before this tragedy hit Afghanistan, we have been concerned and very worried about this large number of Afghans who are returning back to Afghanistan. So the number that we are mentioning to you, 2.4 million Afghans, more than half of these are deportations. People who have been put on buses and other forms of transport and left at the borders to go home. And it has already put a further restraint on our ability to support. So yes, we have been in touch with authorities in Pakistan, continuously contacting them and asking for voluntary, a gradual and a humane response, and we have offered our support to them for all those registered Afghan refugees who are inside the country. That number currently stands at 1.4 million. As we have seen, you know, Afghanistan over the past 45 years has been going from one disaster to another disaster. We have seen displacement inside the country. People have been affected by droughts and recurring earthquakes and mass return of its people, many of whom would be very, very worried to return home in these conditions, and also added a humanitarian crisis and also the human rights situation inside the country.
Thank you very much. In the room, I don't see other hands. So Antonio Broto, Spanish News Agency.
Hello. So I would like to ask all humanitarian agencies if they have any information about the landslide that has caused more than 1,000 deaths in Darfur. Especially, I would like to know if you have access to this area to provide assistance, or if you have requested it to the parties in conflict.
Okay, Antonio, let me see if there are other questions on Afghanistan before we go to yours. I'm asking the colleague online if there's any other question. I don't see other hands up or in the room. So, I don't know if anybody wants to answer this. We will have a speaker from Sudan, at the end of the briefing, the representative of UN Women who's connecting from Port Sudan, so he may have more on this, but I'm looking at Jens or the other colleagues. Do you have anything
On Sudan, we are trying to verify the figures. We hope to have a flash update out in the course of the day that we will send to all of you. And then just, if I may, just one point on Afghanistan. The humanitarian coordinator mentioned the appeal and that it's 28% correct. But I don't think he mentioned how big the appeal is, and it's $2.4 billion for this year.
Thanks for this important detail. So Antonio, come back when we speak with Ms. Nkurunziza, but may have something to add. But otherwise, I'll close. Yes? Sorry? A question to Jens? Yeah, please go ahead.
Thanks, Jens. Just about the, what has been the response from the international community? You mentioned 28%, $2.4 billion that was in the appeal. Since this earthquake has happened, what has been the response? I mean, have people come forward to OCHA to say, we want to help?
The initial response, which came already yesterday, was as you would expect, because that's why we have an emergency fund, is that the Central Emergency Response Fund released $5 million. And that was kind of just, I would say, very fast, realizing how massive this crisis is on the background of very, very severe funding cuts that we've seen since the start of this year. So that is the situation. Now, of course, the next step, which was also alluded to, will be the emergency appeal, probably in the form of a flash appeal. I don't have a date yet for that, but it is something that we are working on as fast as we possibly can. And when we have it ready, of course, we will present that to you.
Thank you very much. Yeah, we will continue speaking about that, I'm pretty sure. Thanks to all the colleagues. And I'll ask now Jeremy to come to the podium. Thanks a lot. So, Jeremy, thank you very much for bringing us a subject which is also very important, and is the situation in Myanmar. You brought us James Rodhever. I think I don't need to introduce James. We've had the pleasure to hear him several times. He's the head of the Myanmar team of OHCHR, and he's speaking from Bangkok. You want to start, and then we go to James?
Yes, thanks, Alessandra. James will come on afterwards and take your questions. This morning, our office published a report on Myanmar detailing the worsening human rights crisis, particularly in Rakhine State. The report provides a stark reminder of the atrocities committed by the military in 2017, pointing to increased killings, torture, and the razing of villages. Since the escalation of hostilities in Rakhine, hundreds of thousands more people have been displaced. The United Nations estimates some 150,000 Rohingya have fled to Bangladesh since November 2023, joining nearly 1 million already taking refuge there. The military and the Arakan army have acted with near complete impunity, enabling the recurrence of violations in an endless cycle of suffering for the civilian population. Videos and pictures show death, destruction, and desperation, distressingly similar to images that we already saw during the 2017 atrocities committed by the military against the Rohingya. In light of the ongoing violations of international law and the prevailing impunity, the High Commissioner reiterates his previous calls for a full referral of the Myanmar situation to the International Criminal Court by the Security Council. The report, which covers the 14 months up until the 31st of May this year, also examines in detail four incidents involving grave violations, including the targeting of civilian homes, villages, schools and camps for displaced people throughout Myanmar. In one of the incidents, on the 12th of May this year, an airstrike hit a school, killing 24 civilians, including 16 girls and 6 boys, as well as 2 female teachers. According to one witness, all 4 classrooms were destroyed except the roof of the last room. Analysis of pictures and videos received by the UN Human Rights Office corroborated witness accounts. Sources indicate that the military has regularly targeted public administration sites, including schools, with the effect of instilling fear in the public. There was already an established pattern of over 640 instances of military attacks against schools since 2021. Despite calls by the United Nations and the Association of Southeast Asian Nations for the de-escalation of violence, the attacks on civilians continue in violation of international human rights and humanitarian law. The report says that even after declaring a unilateral ceasefire following the earthquake in 2025, the military reportedly launched over 550 attacks and killed over 480 people, on top of the nearly 4,000 deaths from the earthquake itself. At the same time, food security continues to rise, linked to the armed conflict, economic instability, and natural disasters. In 2025, an estimated 15.2 million people, nearly a third of the country's population, were projected to face high levels of acute food insecurity, a sharp increase from the 13.3 million in 2024. Humanitarian funding is urgently required to meet the needs, and we implore member states to act to hold the parties to their obligations to allow help to reach those in need, and to support the international efforts to hold those responsible for violations of international law to account. Thank you.
Thank you very much, James. Okay, now you're on.
Yeah, thank you. I think that the statement I think speaks very well to the content of this report, and the situation in Myanmar, of course, is always getting worse. I would just say that since the time in which this report was written, the situation has continued to worsen. It's not just a question of airstrikes and the continuing use of heavier and heavier munitions in the conduct of airstrikes, but it's also now the growth of ground operations throughout the country by the military, designed specifically to consolidate its control or to expand its control in strategic areas prior to elections that were announced to start in late December this year. So the situation is not good, and particularly in Rakhine State, it is extremely bad, as the report details. I would just say that one of the things that the press statement does not highlight is, of course, the ongoing restrictions imposed in the country, especially regarding communications restrictions, make verification of the details of some incidents extremely difficult. And so we have noted in the report that there are times in which those restrictions, as well as the financial restrictions that my team and I are now under. It makes it very difficult to verify data to a legal standard in some instances. And we've noted that very clearly in the report. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, James, and thanks here to Jeremy. Let me open the floor to questions first in the room, if any. Don't see any hand up. So Christian Ulrich, German News Agency.
Thank you very much, Alessandra. Just to get the figures right, how many Rohingya are there in total, or how many are actually left in Myanmar? Maybe you can shed light on that, Jeremy. Thank you.
Jeremy or James, maybe. James, you can take this one.
Sure. I would say that the estimate has always been that following the exodus in 2017, there were around 200,000 Rohingya still left in communities throughout Rakhine State. But since the fighting renewed in November of 2023, those numbers have dwindled significantly, probably as much as a third of those Rohingya still remaining in Rakhine State have now fled abroad or to other locations inside the country. So right now, I don't think anyone knows for certain how many are there, but my guess would be close to 400,000 are still left.
Thank you. Nika Mimbrus, New York Times.
Thank you for taking my question. A rather political question, I'm afraid, James, but we've seen the US withdrawal of sanctions against individuals. We've seen Chinese pressure on arms supplies to resistance groups. And one sees kind of escalating military activity in quite a large area. I mean, a few months ago, we saw reports that essentially the government was losing control of more and more territory, and I'm just wondering if that has changed now and you're seeing the government successfully reoccupying areas it's lost, and whether its offensives are penetrating resistance, the ethnic armed groups' territories and their areas of control. Thank you.
James.
I think you can see that the military has clearly gained momentum. Tactics that they have used, particularly since the earthquake, of launching persistent airstrikes, artillery barrages, and following it up with troop deployments on the ground to really press their advantage against armed groups that they know are hurting, either because of the earthquake, because of the restrictions on humanitarian assistance, and the dwindling humanitarian assistance and international assistance available more broadly, and plus these areas of pressure that have been placed by some of the military's allies abroad to really try to press the need for these elections that the military has announced. It clearly has resulted in the military gaining momentum, both on the ground and I think politically. The military was given credit for some of the earthquake response, which, to all accounts from what I have seen, is not warranted, because it's very unclear whether, first of all, it's very clear that they were not involved in hardly any of the humanitarian response whatsoever. And then the money that was released to the military by certain states in the delivery of assistance, it's very unclear where that money has gone. I think that the military has utilized this political momentum to gain greater legitimacy, and you see the impact on the ground.
Thank you, James. Yes, Associated Press, Jamie Keaton.
Mr. Rodehaver, thank you for coming to see us again. I just wanted to, one of the figures that came out in the press release was this, which I don't think was mentioned here, maybe I missed it, was this 7,100 figure of casualties, the toll that you verified from 2001 to 2025, if I understand correctly. Can you tell us a little bit about how exhaustive you think that figure is? Is that a full compendium? And do you think that the actual toll may be a lot higher? Thanks.
Yeah, I think that is without a doubt the floor of the number of fatalities, civilian fatalities that has occurred in the conflict. And I think that that's for a variety of reasons. One, that, you know, the same communication restrictions that have made our work incredibly difficult, including in areas like Rakhine State, in Sagaing, where fighting has been incredibly intense, in the southeast of the country, where fighting has also been very intense. The figures coming back on fatalities in those areas are just absurdly small, particularly if you compare it in any way to the reported levels of casualties that we have gotten consistently from those areas that could not be verified. So that 7,100 figure, those are verified, meaning that those are numbers where the sources compiling that data can place a name to the death. They have been able to verify that down to the body. And so we know that those figures are incredibly reliable, but those figures are also casualties or fatalities caused directly by the military. That does not include civilians that have been killed by the armed groups, including civilian officials that work for the military or people that have been accused of being informants for the military who were civilians. For a variety of reasons, that data has been incredibly difficult to verify or to account for. But, you know, the military places those figures in thousands. We have tried but have not been able to verify those statistics or find a credible way of estimating them. So I think that by any account, the figure of 7,100 is, I think it's helpful, but it is not in any way exhaustive or comprehensive.
Oh, very clear. Other questions on Myanmar? I don't see any. James, thank you so much for coming back and brief our journalists. And please feel free to come anytime for updates. Before letting you go, Jeremy, I think you have another item on Cameroon. Thank you. Thanks again, James.
Yes, thanks again. Ahead of the presidential election in October, growing restrictions on civic and democratic space in Cameroon are raising fears about whether voters can freely express their will. We are today calling on the government of Cameroon to ensure an environment conducive to a free, transparent, inclusive, and genuine vote. Equal access to participation in electoral processes for all Cameroonians is absolutely essential. Several gatherings have been banned amid rising restrictions on the activities of opposition political parties in the lead-up to the vote. There have also been concerns about the exclusion of some political figures from the race and irregularities in voter registration. Recently, a live television interview with a political figure was interrupted by security forces. These developments come following the suspension of three civil society organisations and the banning of two others in December last year, and restrictions that were imposed on the operations and funding of some civil society groups. High Commissioner Volker Turk is urging the Cameroonian authorities to promptly address any measures that could disenfranchise sections of Cameroonian society and to take meaningful steps to address rising hate speech, disinformation, and incitement to violence, both online and offline, in line with international human rights law. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jeremy. Yes, and yes.
Yes, thank you, AFP here. I just wanted to ask you for a precision. The person who was interrupted during the interview, if you could give us his or her name and give us more details. Thank you.
Yes, sure. So this was an incident related to an interview conducted on STV. It was on the 7th of August of this year. It involved an interview with Dieudonné Yebga. He is a former senior member of the African Movement for New Independence and Democracy, so Menidem. He was, in fact, a rejected presidential candidate. One of 71 of those were who were rejected. The interruption occurred at about the 8-minute mark of the interview, and he was reportedly escorted out by a group of uniformed police, accompanied by civil administrative authority.
Thank you very much, Jeremy. I don't see other hands up for you. So thanks again for these items we're bringing, James. And last but definitely not least, as I announced before, let's go to Port Sudan, where we have Salvatore Nkurunziza. We have already heard from Mr. Nkurunziza in the past. He has come back to tell us about the situation of women in El Fasher as UN women representatives in Sudan. Mr. Nkurunziza, please.
Good morning, colleagues. Good morning, members of the press. Over 500 days of siege in Darfur, El Fasher, is a serious problem. For more than 500 days, women and girls in El Fasher, North Darfur, have borne the brunt of the relentless siege, cut from humanitarian aid and the protection. They face a daily risk of starvation as a weapon of war, discriminated bombardment leading to deaths and sexual violence. For the past 3 weeks, the United Nations has recorded at least 125 civilian deaths in the area, including summary execution, with the actual death toll likely higher. Since April 2023, more than 600,000 people have been displaced from El Fasher and its surrounding camps. Inside the city, women and girls are enduring famine-level conditions as classified by the IPC. With the food stocks depleted and efforts by the United Nations and its partners to move in with supplies hampered by attacks, families are now surviving on animal feed and tree leaves. There have been repeated attacks on humanitarian personnel and the assets in North Darfur over recent months. More than 41 health and education facilities in the state have been destroyed and the supplies of medicine have been depleted. Pregnant women are giving birth in the hands of unskilled attendants with no access to emergency obstetric care. Women in need to reproductive health services and the survivors of rape have no access to any medical services. I'm speaking about the bitter and the painful suffering of women and girls trapped in the city of El Fasher, said Zahara, a mother still inside the besieged city. We are facing deaths by missiles, starvation, daily violations, and rape. Since the conflict began, 1.79 million internally displaced population represent 8% of the total IDPs in Sudan have been living in North Darfur state. More than half of them, women and girls, represent 54%. There have been repeated deadly incursions into the Abu Souk displacement camp, where famine conditions were identified in December 24, 2024, unfortunately. The violation against women and girls in El Fasher are mounting and must be recognized as a grave breaches of international law. Conflict-related sexual violence, including rape and gang rape, has been systematically deployed as a weapon of war. At the same time, starvation is being used as a method of warfare deliberately inflicted on the civilians in a direct violation of international humanitarian law. Women-led organizations and the women volunteers are and remain the backbone of community survivors. Despite scarce resources, they are on the front line, addressing the needs of women and girls. They urgently need direct and sustained support to continue their work. UN Women condemns all violations against women and girls and joins the Secretary General calling for immediate ceasefire in and around El Fasher area, for immediate steps to be taken to protect civilians and enable a safe, unhindered, and sustained delivery of humanitarian assistance into the area, and to allow any civilian seeking to leave the area voluntarily to do so safely. This is in compliance with the Security Council Resolution 2736, which demands an end to the siege of El Fasher and the South Kordofan, protection of civilians, especially women and girls in the civilian premises. The suffering of Sahara is the suffering of every woman and girls in El Fasher today. Their courage must be met with decisive global action. The world cannot remain silent. Member States and the international community must act with urgency and courage. For the women and girls in El Fasher, every day is a matter of survival. The time to act is now. Thank you.
Absolutely, Mr. Nkurunziza, and I would like to also call the attention of the journalists to the statement that we distributed to you of last Friday, where the Secretary General expressed this alarm at the situation in Sudan, and in particular, he called for an immediate ceasefire in El Fasher and areas around, and insisted that immediate steps must be taken to protect civilians and enable the safe, unhindered, and sustained delivery of humanitarian assistance into the area, and to allow any civilians seeking to leave the area voluntarily to do so safely. And you have this Friday statement in your mailboxes. So let me open now the floor to questions. If there is any in the room, I don't see any, or online. I'll give you a moment. I don't see any hand up. But thank you very much, Mr. Nkurunziza. It's very important to continue spotlighting the very dire situation, especially of women and girls in Sudan. So thank you very, very much, and good luck with your so important work in Port Sudan, from Port Sudan, where you are at the moment. Thank you. I'd like to ask Pernille to come to the podium. That concludes our topics of today, but we have a very nice announcement from UNFPA, and we need good news. So I let Pernille talk to you about this nice appointments. You want to push the...
Thank you very much, Alexander. Yes, indeed, we do need good information. Good morning, everyone. I'm very pleased to share that yesterday UNFPA, the United Nations Sex and Reproductive Health Agency, proudly announced that UNFPA India has appointed actress and entrepreneur Kriti Sanon as the National Honorary Ambassador for Gender Equality. Kriti Sanon is partnering with UNFPA to advance opportunities and empowerment for women and girls. Kriti is a National Film Award winner recognized for her outstanding performances in major Indian films. Many of her roles carry strong messages on women's empowerment, choice, and equality. An engineer by training, Kriti's journey from STEM to cinema and her move into producing and entrepreneurship showcases her resourcefulness and constant drive to diversify her craft and influence. With over 80 million social media followers, she brings extraordinary reach, not only within India, but also globally. And over the next 2 years, she will drive awareness campaigns, undertake field visits to interact with communities, and engage with governments and global leaders to advocate for UNFPA's mission towards gender equality. We're very excited about this new collaboration, and if any of you would like to interview Kriti, then we are, of course, happy to facilitate connection to that. I thank you.
80 million is a dream.
It sure is.
Dream number of followers. So happy that she accepted this appointment. Don't know if there's any question to UNFPA, to Pernille? I don't see any, but please take the opportunity, and we will see. Maybe she'll pass by Geneva one of these days,
and we'll
have the pleasure to have her here talking to you. Thank you so much, Pernille.
Thank you,
So maybe I was thinking maybe you could come just 1 second to the podium so I can introduce you to the colleagues so that you see Ricardo's face. So, you know, we have, thank you so much, Pernille. We have a fantastic spokesperson for UNICEF, who is James Elder. But now we have a second fantastic spokesperson for UNICEF, who is Ricardo Pires, who I'm introducing to you. I think it's your first day in the office and your first day at the briefing. So just wanted to show you his face. We know Ricardo from a long time because he's been working at the global level for communication for UNICEF for a long time, but maybe you want to say one word about yourself, and we welcome you here.
Yes, hi everyone. Thanks, Alessandro, for the intro. I'm very, very happy to be here. I was with the media team in New York for the last 2.5 years, so working very closely on Gaza, of course, state of Palestine, Sudan, and many other humanitarian crises that we are facing today, affecting children everywhere. And I've just started my new assignment here, working with James as a deputy spokesperson. So whenever he's doing his travels, which, as we've seen, is quite a lot, I'll be trying to kind of fill in the gap and continue to brief you not only on humanitarian emergencies, but also development issues and other areas of UNICEF's program. So thank you, and very happy to be here.
Yeah, and your email is ricardo.pires@unicef.org.
rpires@unicef.org.
rpires@unicef.org. And of course, we will include Ricardo in the updated list of spokespersons that, as you know, we always prepare at the fall. And he's already in our list. So thank you very much.
Welcome
to the UN Geneva Communications community. Thanks for being here. And that leaves me with a few other announcements. You can stay, no worries. Just to remind you that, first of all, you had Claire Newlis on your list, on your agenda. Claire had very little time today, so she tells me that you have received the press release on their latest, I think it's the publication. She asks me to remind you that on Thursday, 4th of September, at 12 noon, you will have a press conference by Lorenzo Labrador, who is WMO's scientific officer, who will will talk to you about the WMO Air Quality and Climate Bulletin 2024. This is under embargo until 6 o'clock Geneva time on Friday, 5th of September. So you will have this press conference from WMO. Two more press conferences to remind you, it's for the human rights. The first on Wednesday, 3rd of September at 10:30 with Ambassador Jürg Lauber, the president of the UN Human Rights Council that, as you know, starts its 60th regular session on Monday. And that's going to be, as I said, at 10:30, while at 12:30, OHCHR is asking you to come together to hear from the UN Disability Rights Committee, which will present their findings on their latest session. They will be online, and the moderator will be in the press room. I'm pretty sure it's already finished, but this morning the Conference on Disarmament was holding a public plenary meeting under the presidency of Mexico, and we will announce you the next meeting soon. An important committee which is starting on Monday is the Committee on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights. This is their 78th session. They will open on Monday at 10 a.m. The countries to be reviewed under this session are the Russian Federation, Colombia, Chile, and the Netherlands, Zimbabwe, and La OPDR. So you have the program of the report review on the website. And this, I think, brings me to the very end of this briefing. If there are no further questions, and I don't see any hand up, I wish you bon appétit, and I'll see you on Friday. Thank you.